Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do the honors and introduce our guest.
All right. Yes, thank you, Dr. On. I am so glad to be introducing our guest today. His name is Ben Lunine. He goes by Benny. He's going to be discussing a really important topic. It's about advanced healthcare directives for the LGBTQIA communities. Welcome to the show, Benny.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay. So this is a topic that the three of us are very familiar with, but my understanding from the work that I've done over the last decade or so is that this is not something that a lot of people know about and understand. And so let's break down a couple of things. So LGBTQIA, we might want to parse that out for people. And then also communities. Oftentimes people just say community. I'm actually happy to see that you said communities in that description. And so maybe why that is. And then we'll just jump into what are advanced healthcare directives and why are they so important?
Sure. And I can give you a little bit of my background in this work. I was previously an attorney and began over 20 years ago with assisting people with advanced healthcare directives. That was when I clerked at the AIDS Legal Referral Panel in San Francisco after law school in 2005, prior to the ability for people in same gender relationships or anyone outside of the heterosexual dynamic to get married. We relied on advanced healthcare directives to name who we would want to make decisions for us if we could not speak for ourselves, right? If we became incapacitated. So an advanced healthcare directive is an example of a legal document that queer people, and I'm using that term broadly, can rely on kind of prior to marriage or for people who might not want to get married or have reasons they can't get married. Maybe it would impact their ability to collect disability, or there are many complicated reasons that someone might not be able to or choose not to get married. The Advanced Healthcare Directive is a document we've had for a long time where people in our communities can do things like choose who they want to make decisions for them. And the other main purpose of the directive is to express your wishes. So when this document becomes effective is when you can no longer speak for yourself, whether that's temporary or in a more unfortunate permanent situation. You can't speak for yourself, so you need someone else to speak for you. And ideally, you've put down on paper what your wishes are so that your wishes are known. And I always say LGBTQIA communities, because we are very distinct communities. The needs of a transgender person may be very different from a lesbian person. And while I was practicing law prior to becoming a chaplain, I spent some time as a staff attorney at the Transgender Law Center. And at the time, it's no longer on the website, but when I was there, the Transgender Law Center was California specific, and we created an advanced healthcare directive specific for transgender people. And that's a good time to just pause and say, I can only speak broadly to the United States. And now I've been in Oregon for 10 years. I can really only speak with expertise to Oregon at this point. But advanced healthcare directives are really state by state. For trans people in general, there are things that, and I as a trans man myself, I'll say we to include myself in that community, we, and of course, each person's individual. And for any member who's part of the larger queer community, there may be things that are important to highlight.
I'm not exactly sure if I'm remembering the name correctly, but I'm thinking Sharon Kowalski. Was that the name of the lesbian woman who was in a relationship with another woman who went into a coma? And then she was barred from visiting because she wasn't family. So this might have been maybe in the 90s, early 90s, late 80s. And then her family showed up and they forbid the other person to be involved. She eventually came out of the coma, but it was quite a while later. I think it was a couple of years or more. And then when she found out what had happened to her partner, it was not good for the family dynamics, that's for sure. But so I remember at the time thinking, oh, it's really important that we have some other system that protects us. so that we can visit, we can make those decisions, because an advance directive gets notarized, which then makes it, like you said, legal. As a social worker, I did a lot of advance directives. We internally notarized, but I never thought of it as a legal document. I always thought of it as a healthcare document. So I'm liking that we're bridging. It's similar to an informed consent form, which we've talked about many times on our channel, about how it's a medical and a legal document, you know, with an advance directive. Do you remember that story of that woman?
Vaguely. And I want to say a few things. One is, it's going to depend on the state. Like in Oregon, it can be notarized or witnessed, that little technicality.
Oh, good. Yeah.
US or wherever you are, and whatever the document equivalent is called, you'll want to check. But your story reminds me of another story from when I was a young lawyer, and there was this trans guy who got in a motorcycle accident. This wasn't a big legal case, but just something we were aware of on the East Coast. And Shannon Minter was able, he was fortunately conscious, but not in a legal relationship, but had a partner, beloved partner, who was unable to make decisions for him, though, because they weren't in a legal relationship and he didn't have an advanced healthcare directive and he was estranged from his family. But fortunately, he had what we, the three of us, know to call capacity to sign an advanced healthcare directive. And Shannon Minter was able to visit him in the hospital and help him fill out an advanced directive so that his partner could be his decision maker. And what I want to highlight about both of these stories are, my big message with advanced healthcare directives is to be proactive and create one now before an emergency. Because the scary thing is if something happens kind of after the fact, and this is what I see in the hospital, and I'm sure Xander's seen and An has seen, is, and I'm seeing it unfortunately right now, I don't want to go into the details, but a transgender, a non-binary person who uses female pronouns in my hospital right now in Portland, who's intubated and estranged from her family and has a trusted friend, but no advanced healthcare directive. And I'm an ICU chaplain, right? And I'm just, every day I message the nurse saying, let me know if she has capacity. I'm ready. If she has capacity, I'm ready to come by and see if she's interested and can. That's kind of how real and daily this is for me as a chaplain and as someone who's goes the extra mile when it comes, well, for any patient really, but especially with our communities, knowing that there can be extra vulnerabilities.
So I don't want to go too much off the track, but because it's on my mind, I just want to make sure I mention it. The concerns that I've always had, because I've experienced this both on a professional level as well as personally, are the comments when people are in comas, the comments, the negligent way that professionals practice in statements that they make in front of the individual who's in a coma and their family members, because the assumption is that they don't hear or they can't somehow process it. And then, of course, these cases that come up from time to time where the person does come out of the coma and then is able to translate some of those experiences and verbatim feed them back to family and the professionals as being very daunting. I just wanted to know, I've seen rapid hands-on treatment to try to spare someone from going into cardiac arrest because there was no advance directive. And then hearing some of the statements made by professionals that were just very, very insensitive to that person as well as their family. I'm sure you've seen it, heard it, and experienced it. Can you speak a little bit to that? And then we can get back on track.
No, that's very important. Yeah. I'm very fortunate. I've been at my hospital almost 9 years, and it's a hospital in Portland, Oregon. It's a hospital where we do gender-affirming surgery. It's a hospital where we have cultural humility trainings. So it's a hospital where a lot of our providers wear the trans pin on their badges. So I'm pretty lucky in that sense. And I reinforce correct pronouns when I overhear misgendering in rounds, any time in chart note, I will, And because I being somewhere for 9 years and a first or second year resident, even though in the hierarchy they're a doctor, I still feel comfortable enough and I'm older to write a polite message, letting them know the right pronoun. So part of what I do is educate. I educate the team about when there's misgendering. It's usually not intentional. That's the good thing about at least my hospital and being in Portland. It's usually not intentional, has been my experience. This is part of my advocacy that I brought into law that I bring as a chaplain. I assume good intent in terms of how I collaborate with people. I just bring that to any interaction. And I mean, if something were happening in a code or that sort of thing, I would think that like the medical reviving has to happen first. And then certainly as part of the debriefing and education moving forward, it would be critical for people to understand the correct pronouns and gender identity of the patient and communicating. I would go so far as, because this is so important, especially if the patient died, as a chaplain, I often would go with a provider to talk to family, to be really clear en route to talk to family, hey, this is the person's gender. So I think that's some of the advocacy. I don't know if that fully answered your question.
Well, it wasn't the beast I was chasing, but I'm glad you brought it up. I am, because I just thought about, okay, so do people in general, trans people, does our community in general add the request to remain true as they're dying so that people honor their truth? So we have an advanced directive and the hospital receives that, clinic receives it, whomever works with this individual and their family receives this. Have you seen it ever stated on the advanced directive, please do not deter from my pronouns? However, I'm not stating it eloquently or professionally in this sense, but the layperson would understand, right? That this is so important to have it as part of the document that honors the end of life treatment for that person.
Yeah, and I don't think that should be limited to end of life. Yeah, and that's something actually, if we talked about recommendations for a trans person or non-binary person, I know not every non-binary person identifies as trans, for an advanced directive that including pronouns may be appropriate. As I said, that wouldn't be limited to end of life. I mean, that's just the general thing. In my hospital and in the larger system my hospital is a part of, we have pronouns in the patient's chart. So what's nice is that's part of intake. You wouldn't even need an advanced directive for that. And what's, for better or worse, there's legal sex, there's gender identity. So it's a pretty good system. That's very limited to my system. I'm just giving that as an example and perhaps as a model. But yeah, that's absolutely something to include on an advanced directive for anyone who uses pronouns that may differ from their assigned sex at birth.
Benny, you were talking about when you accompany the doctor to go speak with the family, and whether it's just to give an update or if it's to deliver the news of their passing, and how in that walk between where you're starting and where you're meeting with the family, talking about, remember, this was that person's name and these are the pronouns they use, this was their gender identity. I'm wondering, how do you navigate that, especially when it's delivering the news of somebody's passing, deliver that information in that way that honors the patient, that could be contributing to or exacerbating the grief and the loss because the family hasn't fully accepted their child's new name or pronouns or gender identity. So you're delivering news about a person that on the surface they don't recognize, they don't accept, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear that name. They don't want to hear that gender. They don't want to hear those pronouns. Have you ever encountered that? And just what are your thoughts on how to work with families that aren't able to hear the message as delivered, which is honoring the patient, but could be considered dishonoring the parents?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that example of a sudden death is very specific, but it's nuanced. I mean, I'm thinking of an example where we had someone who died who was trans, and her sister let us know that she was not out to her parents and she did not want to be out. And so I remember, even though it felt really uncomfortable to me personally, that's not the priority. So I used her birth name. I don't use dead name personally, but I used her birth name and male pronouns because I wanted to honor. And my understanding was she was very close with her sister. And so I wasn't going to out her because my understanding was that's not where she was with the process. And so it is nuanced. And I don't have some agenda that's going to supersede my patient's autonomy and wishes. And so it is nuanced, right? It's always going to depend on the situation. And I believe good care is patient-centered care. So yeah, sometimes when there are trans patients in the hospital, in their chart, it might say a name that's a quote unquote preferred name, but then we may find out that's not the name their family knows them by. And we're just careful as a team to really understand what is important and safe for them. I'm not talking about pediatrics here. I'm talking about adults. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's just so many different cultural issues that can come into play. So I just thought it'd be interesting to put that out there. When you talk about advanced directive and it's an individual giving another individual, and sometimes more than one individual, you can have a first and a second person that you designate decision-making authority if you lack capacity, meaning you're unconscious or you're delirious or something is happening. And so even if you're having a mental health crisis as well, right, with dealing with delusions or something like that. And so when my father had dementia, and when he was admitted into the assisted living facility, when his care needs escalated beyond my abilities, I was very good at getting all that paperwork done. We sat down with an elder law attorney and we got all the paperwork done, and he had his big DNR on yellow paper on the back of his door.
Are you referring to a pulsed?
Do not resuscitate order for people.
The pulsed, right? The physician's order.
Yeah. But I was watching one of those medical shows recently on streaming. The patient was designated DNR, do not resuscitate. However, they were not designated DNI, do not intubate. And I was like, oh my God, nobody ever talked to me about that. The DNR was like, don't do CPR, but it didn't include things like putting the tube down the throat in order to give direct access to the lungs with air. Now I know to tell people to sit down with somebody who can walk you through, right? A chaplain, a social worker, a lawyer who's specializes or very clear on advanced directives, like, because it's hard to think about when there's not any emergency or crisis to think about what are all the types of decisions that are going to need to be made. It's like while they're in that medical setting, where they're discharged to, what kind of services are available. There's so many things to think about. Will we or won't we approve the feeding tube? Gon was saying previously about the types of conversations that are going on around people in coma and how uncomfortable people are talking about this. I think this is another area where I don't know if people are uncomfortable. It's just outside of our day-to-day thinking, what do I want people to do when I'm in a coma or when I'm incapacitated for some reason? We don't think that way.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Benny is what he goes by, Lunine, who discusses the importance of advanced healthcare directives for the LGBTQIA communities. We hope that you've enjoyed it so far, and we are always grateful to our sponsors who sponsor our show, and therefore happy to play their commercials. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good. Good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato. Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle Magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Benny Lunine. Let's get back to where we left off.
Until maybe we get much older, and then by then we can find that we're a little too late because we've fallen in the shower and now we don't have this documentation. If we're legally married, it's a little okay because we have a spouse who can make decisions for us, but we don't know that they'll necessarily make the ones we would like them to be making. And I think that's another thing. Oftentimes people think a healthcare surrogate or advocate or the person that's designated, it's their wishes. No, they're just making sure your wishes are the ones that are being followed in the setting. Yeah. So I think that was kind of two things, like thinking through all the different things. We can't go through all the different decision-making topics, but that also the designated person doesn't get their way.
From an ethics framework, it's called substituted judgment. That's what your surrogate decision makers should be doing. They should be stepping into the shoes of you and carrying out your wishes. Xander, I like that you brought up, I think you're talking about a pulse. So there's the Advanced Healthcare Directive, which goes into effect if you become incapacitated. And then there's a pulse, a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. And that's the kind of thing you would hang on your fridge often or somewhere else, somewhere very obvious, so that if something happened and EMTs came, they would hopefully see. Usually would only have it if you were do not attempt resuscitation or do not resuscitate, because otherwise they would go ahead and attempt resuscitation. Yeah, and it is a good point. Would they intubate? Ideally, especially if you're someone who leans more towards less interventions for whatever reasons, maybe you have other comorbidities or serious illnesses, maybe you're elderly for whatever reasons, maybe you're not someone who would want CPR, considering if you don't already have one, doing what we call a pulse with your primary physician, if you have one, is a great idea.
I'm glad, Xander, that you mentioned that, because we also have medical aid in dying. You have that in Oregon? Is that legal in Oregon? Yeah.
We call it death with dignity.
Okay. I know it's different state by state. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of expertise with it. I believe you need a prognosis of 6 months or less. And there's certain caveats about around mental health. There's a concern that this isn't stemming from depression, which I always think is funny because I think it would be understandable if you were depressed. There's certain caveats around that. Part of the reason I don't have more expertise with it is it's not something we do in the hospital. So it's outside the hospital.
Well, that makes sense. When you say a prognosis of 6 months, that's typically when somebody might be referred over to hospice. So it's giving people that opportunity to do that slow morphine drip death versus just get it done with, which is why they call it death with dignity. Because having witnessed now my wife's father and my own father going through hospice, I'm not hard and fast on whether I believe or disbelieve or agree or disagree with these different options, but it wasn't fun witnessing it. It felt like it was a time that they were giving me. It was like my window to slowly accept. And I would have been fine with it being much shorter than that. You know, I think it was like a 3 month time period. But yeah, I know that Canada has some similar law or program that's more on a national scale.
So in terms of advanced directives for non-binary or trans people specifically, I've been thinking about, I know this came up a long time ago when I was working at the Transgender Law Center, specifically around a particular person who had died and then unfortunately how their family had them presented at her funeral. Things like grooming is something you could put in advanced healthcare directive, especially while someone, if you were in the hospital and not conscious, there may be stuff around facial hair, or I'm throwing out makeup as an example that might not be relevant, but just if there are things having to do with grooming that relate to dignity, that might be really important for trans women. I'm using facial hair an example. That could be extremely important. I've heard stories of people not getting their hormones. If you take hormones, that might not be thought of as essential, whereas that could be extremely essential. You might be a trans man who has not had a hysterectomy and starts to menstruate again. Or we can, of course, think about many examples for people of all genders. So noting my hormones should be given to me under all circumstances. That's just an example. So of grooming, hormones, pronouns, as we mentioned, these are my pronouns, being very clear. And something came up. I had a trans patient, and this was just something, a recent thought I had. It's something you could attach to an advanced healthcare directive, whether you're someone who has caregivers or like letter to my future caregivers. This was just something creative that came up for me recently. And it could be more than just your identity as a trans person and what that can include as it relates to healthcare, just as a creative possibility. The nice thing about advanced healthcare directives is they're not limited. You can always use the form for your state if you're in the United States, but you can attach more pages to them. You're always welcome to add information. And that was just something that came up that I wanted to mention, because you never know what could happen in life, right? Something serious could happen. You could be in a care facility. You could be in the hospital, and then you could be in a skilled nursing facility. You could need personal caregivers. And that's something to consider, whether, again, grooming, hormones, etc., pronouns, just to relay information about this aspect of your identity and what it involves. So I just wanted to be sure to get that in, because I know that was the umbrella, so to speak, right? Yeah. Topic of this podcast.
Absolutely. Benny, really quickly follow up to that. Does an advanced directive carry forward to funeral services? So if you have an advanced directive name and issues around grooming and clothing also, would it follow with you into that setting?
I think its effectiveness ends at the time of death, but you could certainly express your wishes, and the hope is they'd be honored. I think that you would want to, there's no harm in doing that. And then ideally you would execute a will, and the executor of your state, and you would want to reinforce these things. You can often, as part of, for people, and I speaking with a degree of privilege, and for people who are able to create estate planning documents, these are the things you can include in your estate planning documents, who you would want to be in charge of your postmortem affairs and directions around that. Not everyone would have a memorial. Certainly not everyone would have like an open casket. This was a very specific example where this poor trans woman had parents who had her dressed in a very masculine appearance.
I was raised Catholic, so it was always open casket. So I immediately think of that.
So we had somebody from our community who passed away, had been holding on, and eventually was referred to hospice, trans female. And there was some disagreement with family members. Some of us didn't actually witness that. One of our friends, who's an attorney, also trans, managed that aspect of it. But we would go in there and we made sure that staff were up to date on pronouns and what have you. And then there were a couple of people who came in and took care of her physical needs, which was really so important to her.
Yeah. And one thing, just as an aside, that we'll do in my hospital is, depending on the situation and the patient's consent, if it's something they want, we might put a little piece of paper on the door with pronouns. What I would like to do to institute is on the whiteboard, that's very typical for a hospital room, it'll say name, room number, whatever. And I would like to just have pronouns for every room. Normalize that, right? That just like everyone uses pronouns, right? Not just trans people. We all use pronouns. So I think it would be very cool to just have pronouns on every whiteboard in every patient room and just have that just be a natural thing that you'd glance when you go in the room to, because the thing is, I always glance in the patient room because their name on the chart, it might be Robert, but then I like to go in and glance because it might say Bobby, because it's like what I like to be called or whatever. So it'd be nice for it to just, you would just glance to see, oh, what do they go by, and to have very clearly next to it pronouns.
I just realized, Xander, that that was such an important aspect of what you just raised in regards to the aftercare once somebody passes on. And the funeral arrangements and what protocols and all the what people do, hinging, I suppose, on their religion or just in general. And that would be really something important, I think, to work with funeral directors.
Yeah, I think in California, if I remember correctly, there is a specific law where, like, if you've changed your name legally, that's what goes on the tombstone or on the, you know, the little drawer or whatever, if you're in the mausoleum. I might not be remembering exactly correctly, but it's been a number of years since that law was passed. Betty probably knows a little bit more about it. We don't need to go into detail, but I guess I had never really thought about it. I'm almost 60 now, so I'm like, oh, I'm starting to think about things I've never thought about before, especially with my dad's passing last year. It just made me want to look more closely into this. And I heard Benny give a similar workshop for an organization, the Intentional Man Project. And I was like, oh, we got to have him on to talk about this with our audience, because again, it's very important, but it's one of those important things that people just aren't really talking about out in public, because it's, I don't think it's taboo. I just think it's one of those things. It reminds me of that movie, A Boynton Beach Memoir, something like that, where when they're talking about Brighton Beach, when they were talking about cancer, they would whisper it. Oh, did you hear about so-and-so? She has cancer. I think it's one of those things. It's just sensitive. But yeah, so we're now towards wrapping up. I don't know if we have enough time for you to really give us a full story about.
I'm asked this question very often. So, as I mentioned, my first career was as an attorney.
We're about maybe 10, 12 minutes away from ending. I would love to hear, it'll be abbreviated or truncated in this case because of the time limit. But Benny, would you be interested in talking a little bit about your going from lawyer to chaplain? What was the catalyst for that? That career trajectory. I would say people might think it's unusual, but as a seminary graduate, I met so many lawyers in seminary. It's not unusual within our fields, but I would imagine people are unfamiliar with that kind of career shift.
I'm asked this question very often. So as I mentioned, my first career was as an attorney. I attended New College of California School of Law in San Francisco, which is unfortunately no longer around, but got a wonderful public interest law school education there. I went in kind of thinking I'd like to do either criminal defense or LGBT law, and then was able to work at the Transgender Law Center and practicing law for about 5 years. And with practicing law, that was often where I got to spend the least amount of time. And it was a lot of time doing legal research and writing. And I just found that I was searching for something different where I could spend all or most of my day with people, because that was really the part that fed me, was being with people during really tender times. And so it's interesting because sometimes I'm asked, it might come up that I was a lawyer before, and some people think, oh, that's so different. But it doesn't feel really different being with people during crises, trying to establish trust. There's a lot of parallels between the kind of lawyer I was and being a chaplain. And I'm really grateful that I took a leap and went to divinity school and got really fortunate. I'm really grateful that I'm at the hospital where I am. An, you might appreciate, we had our first Rosh Hashanah party ever. I'm also Jewish. Sounds like you are too. Last week, it's a historically Episcopalian hospital, and we have a great, very newer interfaith oriented director. And we had our first real Hanukkah party last December. And it's been lovely. It has been what I was hoping for. Aside from charting and committee work and things I do, it is the heart of my day that I'm with patients, I'm with family, I'm supporting staff. I get to be in the ICU, which I love, as well as the step down unit. So I'm in the most acute part of the hospital where I feel like I get to be of service, or at least I try. So yeah, and you're right, Xander, there were certainly a lot of lawyers where I went to school, the Pacific School of Religion, also in Berkeley, and there was a judge as well. And yeah, it has been very fulfilling. And it's great because my experience as a lawyer has served me. And when I went to law school on the very first day in orientation, they said, no matter what happens, going to law school will serve you, even if you don't end up practicing law. And that's been true. And I'll sort of end on a story, given the nature of this podcast, that it's a queer podcast and that we're all in healthcare here. I had the opportunity to do a presentation on advanced healthcare directives, because this has kind of been my theme this year, to the ICU. They have, for nurses, staff meetings, for lack of a better word. They have a term of art. I've served that ICU for probably 6 of my 9 years, so I know them really well. And I haven't been out as trans, and not because I'm closeted, but I'm their chaplain and it just hasn't come up. But it's begun to feel strange to not be out. And I know some of them so well, like the day nurses. And so I was doing this presentation and I just decided it was time. And the lovely part of, I bring it up as part of the story and as part of a topic we didn't cover, but it's just a story to end on. I was able to bring it up because I was going to have 15 minutes to talk about advanced healthcare directives, to just give them more information. And I said, I'm going to share 2 things you may not know about me. One is, I used to be a lawyer. And I said, and you know, I'm doing this presentation today. I've actually been helping people with advanced healthcare directives for over 20 years. I began clerking at a place called the AIDS Legal Referral Panel.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is Benny Lunine, who discusses the importance of advanced healthcare directives for the LGBTQIA communities. We hope that you have enjoyed this conversation. And for those of you who knew very little about the advanced healthcare directive, we're hoping that you have garnered some more information or some new information that will be most helpful to you. We are grateful to UK Health Radio, our listeners, and those of our sponsors and therefore always happy to play their commercials. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at ukhealthradio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is Benny Lunine. Let's get back to where we left off.
And then I was a lawyer at a nonprofit called the Transgender Law Center. And the other thing you may not know is that I'm a transgender man. And then I went on to tell them, you know, I shared this with you because we have relationships. And I said, and I trust you guys. And we have trans patients fairly frequently in the ICU, which is really sad because the most common reason they're there is suicide attempts. And I said, I was sharing it relationally because I know, like I said, I know some of these nurses really well. And I trust them and I want them to know if it feels appropriate. They can say, you know what? We actually have a trans chaplain. I trust these nurses and that I want them to be able to say that because for a lot of us, we've had my experience as a Jew who grew up in a Reformed synagogue is not religious trauma. I'm really grateful. But a lot of us have had religious trauma and may not want to talk to a chaplain, understandably. And to be able to say we have a trans chaplain, what a bridge. And it was so lovely because it's actually a pretty queer ICU and it was only well received. I mean, it was hybrid and there were hearts and comments. And so I just organically wanted to leave y'all with that story.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story, Benny. Thank you so much for sharing it. And I'm glad that it was a positive experience. And I think you're right. There are a lot of people in our community, not just trans, but the various communities, LGBTQIA, as you say, who have had many negative, if not more abusive relationships in religious communities or within religious families, and would automatically reject when somebody said, would you like a chaplain to come visit you? And I think you're right that they would think twice, oh, a trans chaplain. Sure. Thank goodness that you are there for them. So I'm glad that people know now. I would imagine word will spread. So it'll go beyond the ICU. If I know nurses well enough, this will spread if it hasn't already all around the place. But good. I'm glad that it worked out well. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the Umbrella Hour and talk to us about this really important topic about advanced directives and not all the things that we need to do with them, but enough things to get people started to sit down with a chaplain or a social worker or a lawyer and whomever their designated person is to really hash it out and think it through. And then I like to tell people, give a copy to your local hospital. You never know when the ambulance is going to bring you in. I'm a veteran, so I go to the Department of Veterans Affairs. I have an advance directive on file. It is available through all the system, but it's not that easy to access. If I were on vacation in New Hampshire, they might not be able to access the VA records as quickly as they would need to see it. So I try and make it available as much as possible too. So that's another thing to think about. Like, you don't just stick it in a drawer. It needs to be distributed to the decision maker you're designating and any possible hospital locations that you might end up in that are near your home. And of course, your primary care physician or nurse practitioner or physician assistant would probably be a good person to have that on file as well. So I know we're out of time. So I just want to say thank you again. And we'll cut this part out. I'll follow up with you when we go live.
Thank you, Benny.
Okay, thanks for having me, Shana Tova.
Shana Tova to you as well.
Yeah. What a nice guy, huh?
Yeah,
isn't he sweet?
Yeah, he's a sweet guy. And you met, how did you meet him?
Yeah, it's interesting because Benny went to Pacific School of Religion, which is my seminary where I graduated from, but he went after me. But I met him a number of years beforehand, and that was when I was accepted to New College School of Law, which is where Benny graduated. I think I had heard about him through the Bay Area Boys, BA Boys, B-O-Y-Z, okay. Yahoo group. So I said, hey, I've just been accepted to the law school. I'd love a chance to, you know, sit down and chat with you about, I had already been on testosterone. And so I was going to law school as a trans guy. I didn't graduate. I figured out in the first year that because I had come from a law enforcement background and I was finding the same attitudes. My goal was to become public interest focused. I wasn't going to be a litigator like Benny ended up being. I do believe that a degree in law, regardless of how you use it, is a very good foundation, just a way of thinking. Mm-hmm. It's a way of understanding. And I definitely agree with that. But I couldn't at the time fathom another 2 years with those people. Mm-hmm. Because what I didn't understand is in public interest law schools, you have public defender oriented and public and defense attorneys. Mm-hmm. These are both public interests because they work for the government on against each other in the court. And so they're both public interests. So in the setting, they were just at each other. Yeah. And I was like, I just can't even fathom another 2 years with these people. So that's when I started looking into something else and decided on social work.
That was a little different from our usual end of the hour announcements. I thought I would slip that discussion in because Xander is such an interesting person and knows very interesting individuals all over the world. We hope that you enjoyed this hour. We certainly enjoyed spending time with Benny Lunine. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour.